Lecture 25, Dogen and Hakuin, Zen Buddhism.
Hello, welcome back. You may recall that back in Lecture 19, we talked about Buddhism in Japan, how it first came from Korea in the 6th century, and then it adapted various Buddhist schools from China. So there was Saicho and the Tendai school, Kukai and the Shingon school that talked about esoteric Buddhism, and then Honen and the Pure Land school, which developed into the True Pure Land school under Shinran, and then Nichiren Buddhism, with its strong emphasis on the Lotus Sutra. We looked at developments during the Heian period. Remember, this is the classic early empire revolving around the court at Kyoto. And then we followed those Buddhist schools into the Kamakura period, which started in 1185 and went to 1333. And that was the period when the shogun set up his own government system, a military government, in Kamakura. It's in today's Tokyo. So there's still an emperor down in Kyoto, but he's not very important. People don't really pay a lot of attention to him. But the most famous form of Japanese Buddhism, Zen, I said we'd put off until a bit later, since it really comes into prominence in the later medieval period. And here we are. Most forms of Buddhism include meditation among other practices, such as scripture study or chanting, reciting the Nembutsu, remember Amida's name, hoping to be born into the Pure Land, making vows, giving donations, etc. Zen Buddhism says that meditation, under the guidance of an enlightened master, is the only practice that will lead to liberation. Everything else, even if it's good, can still be a distraction. Enlightenment comes when one is able to overcome ordinary thinking and the perception that there's a distinction between subject and object, or self and not self. So if you can get beyond that, you can experience reality directly. The famous verse that describes Zen Buddhism is, I mentioned this in an earlier lecture, a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence upon words or letters, a direct pointing at the soul of man, seeing into one's nature to attain Buddhahood. And remember that, you know, one's own nature is the Buddha nature. That's what you're realizing. Let's go a little bit deeper, though. Do you remember I mentioned in the last lecture Feng Yolan, the great 20th century Chinese Neo-Confucian philosopher? Feng was also a historian of philosophy, and he offered five quick descriptions of Zen. It's Chan Buddhism in China, but we'll call it Zen. The first is, the highest truth is inexpressible. Somehow it's beyond words. Words are the realm of your thinking mind. So Zen masters sometimes communicate with their students in non-verbal kinds of ways. Sometimes they do odd things, or they make seemingly nonsensical statements. Some of those are classified as koans, or they might even strike a student. The second description that Feng Yolan gives is, spiritual cultivation cannot be cultivated. Okay, so enlightenment isn't something that you can work at. It's not like self-cultivation in Neo-Confucianism. You simply realize what has already been true all along. According to the Northern School of Zen Buddhism, this realization comes gradually. In the Southern School, under Huineng, remember he's the guy who wins the poetry contest, the Southern School says that enlightenment happens in a moment, in a sudden flash of insight. Third description. In the last resort, nothing is gained. Okay. Enlightenment doesn't really bring any new knowledge. It doesn't really change anything at all. And then fourth, there's nothing much in the Buddhist teaching. Okay. There's nothing amazing or secret about Zen. It just is. And then finally, in carrying water and chopping wood, therein lies the wonderful Tao. So when a person is enlightened, he or she continues the same sort of life as before. It's just that now, ordinary tasks take on extraordinary meaning. There's a total absorption in the task at hand without the chattering mind getting in the way. Zen puts an emphasis on scrubbing floors, on cooking food, on making tea as forms of meditation, as paths to insight. So there's sitting Zen, and we'll talk in some detail about that, but there's also walking Zen. There's cooking Zen. I suppose there's even latrine cleaning Zen. Zen monks are also known for doing manual labor to support themselves rather than simply living off the revenues of the monastery. Monasteries usually had lands associated with them that had peasants on them that were farming and giving the money, the proceeds, to the monastery. In the modern era, Zen monks still went on begging rounds. Okay, now remember, they're not asking for things. They just walk silently. Everybody knows why they're there, and people will give them donations in their begging bowl, food usually, sometimes a little money. And the Zen monks don't say thanks, or they don't say anything. They just take whatever comes in silence. And this helps develop humility in the monks, and it also gives believers an opportunity to gain merit through generosity. But there's an old Zen saying that a day without working is a day without eating. Now, if you were thinking earlier that those little descriptions, such as in the last result, nothing changes, that sort of thing, if you're saying that sounded a little bit like Taoism, then congratulations, you're learning something. Zen Buddhism fits Chinese culture really well. It will be even more closely associated with Japanese culture. Contact between China and Japan had ended in the turmoil and the anti-foreign sentiment that gripped China in the late Tang Dynasty in the 9th century. But then contact resumed in the 12th century, once China got, restabilized in the Song Dynasty. Once again, in the Song Dynasty, in the 12th century, monks from Japan started to travel to China, and there they discovered that Zen Buddhism had eclipsed Tendai and Shingon. Remember, Shingon actually was never really all that important in China. There were two monks in particular that we should mention, Eisai and Dogen. There are two types of Japanese Zen. Rinzai, that's the southern school of sudden enlightenment, and they focus on koans. And then Soto Zen, and that's the northern school of gradual enlightenment, where you just sit and meditate. Eisai was a late 12th century Japanese Tendai monk. So he made his start at the monastery at Mount Hiei, and he made two trips to China in order to try to find the true Buddhism, to gain some training, to learn from masters there. He returned in 1191 with Rinzai Zen, that's the sudden enlightenment kind, and he also came back with tea, which he reintroduced into Japan and popularized. Now, tea had been earlier into Japan. Kukai, long ago, had brought it, and some of the monks in Kukai's school had used tea, but it never really took off until it came with Zen Buddhism and Eisai. And you can imagine why it was popular with Zen Buddhism, because it was an aid to meditation, right? One of the difficulties of sitting in meditation for hour after hour is you tend to doze off, and a little bit of tea in the afternoon, a little bit of caffeine can sort of perk you up and help you stay alert, because it's important to stay alert as you're meditating. When Eisai encountered religious opposition in Kyoto with his sort of new ideas from China, he went to the court of the newly established shogunate in Kamakura, where his ideas were quite well received. He still continued to be a Tendai monk, though, and he practiced a rather eclectic form of Buddhism that focused on meditation, but still included some of those other practices. A more rigorous type of Zen was established by Dogen, the first great thinker of this lecture. Dogen lived from 1200 to 1253. So 1200, the year he was born, was also the year that the University of Paris was founded. It's about the time of the Magna Carta and Genghis Khan. Dogen was the illegitimate son of a nobleman, and his father died when Dogen was 2. When he was 7, his mother died as well. So he became an orphan, became keenly aware of the impermanence of all things. The story is that when this 7-year-old boy was at his mother's funeral, he saw the smoke from the incense rising and vanishing, and he realized that's pretty much what everything in life was going to be like. As a result, he didn't have much desire for a secular career. He became a Tendai monk at the age of 14. He went to Mount Hiei, even met Eisai when he was 15. But he always had a question that he couldn't get an answer to, not a satisfying answer. The question was, if everyone already has the Buddha nature, why do they have to exert themselves in religious practices in order to attain Buddhahood? He asked a lot of people. As I said, nothing really made sense to him, and so he went to China. At the age of 23, studied with some masters there in Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism, and returned to Japan 4 years later in 1227 with Soto Zen, right? That's the gradual enlightenment. He lived in the outskirts of Kyoto for a while, and then he established a monastery deep in the wilderness to the north. He wrote several books, he taught a few disciples, but didn't have a lot of influence until after his death. Dogen's big idea is the practice of Zazen, of sitting Zen, and the experience of enlightenment are one and the same. So you just sit in meditation without a specific object or a goal in mind. And the way you do this is you sit in the lotus position with your legs sort of crossed, actually with the top of your foot on your thigh in both ways. And then you have to sit up very straight, nice posture. It's a lot easier if you have a cushion under your rear end to support you a little bit. And your head is sort of bowed slightly. Your eyes are not closed, but not open either, sort of half open, half closed, so that you don't really pay any attention to what's outside. Soto Zen monks often meditate facing a wall. And your tongue is against the roof of your mouth, which prevents a lot of salivation, and you just don't have to think about it. And then you put your dominant hand, if you're right-handed, your right hand under your left hand with your thumbs just barely touching. So if you're pushing too hard, you're thinking too hard about it, if they fall, if they're not touching, you're getting distracted. And then you count your breathing sort of in and out. Thoughts, of course, will sort of scramble across your mind. And it's really hard to say, I'm just not going to think of anything, because not thinking of anything is a thought that you're trying to do. So as thoughts come, you just let them go. You don't grab onto them, and eventually you learn how to sort of empty your mind. So this is the way you meditate, and Dogen wrote instructions that are something like this. It's not too comfortable. I mean, if you've ever tried to sit in the lotus position, it can be a little different. You could start with a half lotus or some other, but it's not too comfortable enough that you fall asleep. But it's not so painful that it's excruciating, that it's impossible to do either. And after some practice, you can learn to sit in a meditative position, in the lotus position, for hours at a time. Okay, there are thousands of years behind this practice of meditation. One more thing that sometimes is striking to people who visit monasteries, Zen monasteries, is something called the warning stick. And monks will usually meditate on a raised platform, a couple feet high, and they'll be lined up against the wall. And there will be a master of the meditation hall who will sort of walk up and down with a long, flat stick. And when a monk feels like he's dozing off, perhaps he'll motion to the master, who will whack him, whack, 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 over the shoulder, left shoulder, right shoulder. And it sounds kind of amazing, and it looks like somebody's being beaten, but that's not what's happening. It's mostly just sort of the sound, and it helps to relax their muscles and to sort of bring people back into focus and wake them up. Sometimes it's called the warning stick, sometimes the encouragement stick, which is a nicer way of thinking about it. So sitting in meditation is just what Buddhas do. And when you do it, you too become Buddha, one with the Buddha nature, one with the universe. Any notions of self, of striving, of distinctions between what's me and what's not me, all of those are illusions, and all of those can fall away if you're meditating properly. Enlightenment, and in Japan this is called Satori, is not a matter of gaining anything. It's more a letting go. You forget yourself, and you let the Buddha nature unfold. So things don't have the Buddha nature, they are the Buddha nature. As a result, one can read the mountains and the waters as a Buddhist sutra. Actually, Dogen talked about this in a famous essay. In fact, the whole universe is a sutra. Remember, a sutra is the sacred scriptures, the words of the Buddha. Dogen describes sitting meditation something like this. He says, "Whenever you practice sitting Zen, for however short a while, you mysteriously merge with all existence. You completely permeate all time, and throughout the infinite Dharma realm, you eternally perform past, present, and future Buddha deliverance. Each and every one equally performs the same cultivation and the same realization." Does that sound hard to believe? Perhaps, but Dogen would say it's not a matter of belief. Just do it. Try it out. Zen Buddhism is very experiential. I'm reminded of a New Yorker cartoon There's a group of people at a Zen center. They're sitting in meditation. There's a Zen master at the front, and there's sort of a poster that says the journey to enlightenment. And the caption underneath says, are we there yet? Okay, remember, in Dogen Zen Buddhism, you're not going anywhere. It's not that sort of thing. Or another analogy, I have a sister-in-law who's a nurse, and she did a rotation in early childhood nursing, and she had a mother come in once. This is a brand new mother who came in and said, I'm a little concerned because I'm afraid I'm just not bonding with my baby. And my sister-in-law said, you're not bonding with your baby. I mean, what do you mean? Are you not picking it up? Do you want to throw your baby out the window? I mean, there's nothing magical or mysterious about bonding with your baby. You're already doing what mothers do. Like, that's all there is to it. So also with Dogen, sitting in Zen, sitting meditation, that's all there is to it. Enlightenment is nothing else. Dogen wrote a series of essays, 93 essays, that were collected into a book called Shobogenzo, which is translated as Essence of the Buddhist True Dharma, or alternately translated as the True Dharma Eye Treasury. This is the first major Buddhist text to be composed in Japanese. Before this time, Buddhist monks, as well as a lot of people in elite China, are still writing in elite Japan, are still writing in Chinese. But he's going to write this in Japanese. And he includes nuanced philosophical discussions of the oneness of being and time, reflections on the impermanence and death, explanations of how conceptual thinking actually distorts being as it is, which is actually non-dualistic. This book wasn't published until 1816, but since then, it's attracted quite a bit of attention. Dogen's ideas have been compared with those of Heidegger and Nietzsche and Sartre. Dogen is a major figure in the writings of the 20th century Kyoto school of philosophy. That includes people like Nishida Kitaro and Nishitani Keiji, who try to bring Buddhist concepts and perspectives to bear on Western intellectual movements, such as existentialism and nihilism. Dogen's most famous saying was, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. Dogen didn't entirely reject the use of koans, but they were clearly secondary to Zazen, sitting in meditation with an empty mind. The other Zen school, Rinzai, focused on the achievement of enlightenment as a sudden breakthrough, as an event you could push toward and achieve. And koans are central to that effort. Okay, the word koan comes from the Chinese word gong'an, that means a public record or an announcement. A koan is basically like a Buddhist riddle that's insoluble. An example is, what is the Buddha? And the answer is, three measures of flax. What? How does that work? Is flax, the Buddha nature in flax and in the Buddha? But the point isn't to solve this thing. It's intended to jolt a person out of irrational or logical thinking habits so that he or she can perceive things directly beyond language. Here's another example from our old friend Wei Neng. Without thinking of good or evil, show me your original face before your mother and father were born. A Zen student will ponder a koan and then have regular interviews with a Zen master. They'll do it, you know, every couple days or maybe a week or something. And this interview will take no more than just a few minutes. The Zen master will ask a question, the student will answer, and the Zen master will determine whether the student is still trying to figure things out logically or trying to fake it or has no idea. And he'll ring a bell when he's dissatisfied with the answer. There are no easy answers to these koans, and students struggle over them. They agonize with these for quite some time. Here's an example. Traditionally in Japan, a student will start with one particular koan. It says, a student asks Joshu, who is a Chinese Zen master, does a dog have a Buddha nature or not? And Joshu answered, mu. Okay, mu is the Japanese pronunciation of a Chinese word that means no, or it means there is none. And you can try to think like, there is no dog, there's no Buddha nature, how does this... But of course, dogs do have a Buddha nature according to a lot of the sutras, and you sort of get stuck on this. A 13th century commentary, the Mumonkan offered this advice. You see, don't you want to pass the barrier? That's the barrier of this first koan. Then concentrate yourself into this mu, with your 360 bones and 84,000 pores, making your whole body one great inquiry. Day and night, work intently at it. Do not attempt nihilistic or dualistic interpretations. It's like having bolted a red-hot iron ball. You try to vomit it, but cannot. Okay, students sometimes work on this one koan for months, or even a year or more. Eventually, as you might imagine, there were several collections compiled of koans and a religious tradition that rejected the authority of texts end up having several authoritative texts, collections of koans. But perhaps the most famous koan of all is one by Hakuin, and he's going to be our second great mind for this lecture. His koan is, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" Okay, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I can give you a hint. Slapping your fingers against your palm like this, that's not the answer. Hakuin lived from 1685 to 1768. Okay, that means that he was born the same year as Johann Sebastian Bach. He's probably the most significant of the Rinzai Zen masters. He lived during the Tokugawa shogunate from 1603 to 1868. And that was a time when Japan again had a strong centralized government. Rinzai Zen had long overshadowed Soto Zen, but when Hakuin came on the scene, Rinzai was in a period of decline. It had given rise to wonderful art and literature and crafts, and we'll be talking about that in the next lecture. But it really wasn't a dynamic religious presence anymore. Hakuin revitalizes the tradition by systematizing and categorizing hundreds of koan, and he added many of his own. And in this way, he established a clear, rigorous training program in meditation and koan study. So you work on one, and when you've mastered that one, you can move on to the next in sort of a regular progression. All modern Rinzai Zen masters trace their spiritual lineage through Hakuin. He was also celebrated as a calligrapher and a painter, though painting is something he took up only in his 60s. Hakuin's mother was a devout Nichiren Buddhist, and at the age of 7 or 8, he heard a fiery sermon about the 8 Buddhist hells and the torment and the torture that was there. It terrified him so much that when he was taking a hot bath not long thereafter, and the steam was coming up and it was getting hotter, because Japanese baths are much hotter than American baths are, little Hakuin imagined what hell might be like in the afterlife, and he screamed in terror. He became a monk at the age of 15 against his parents' wishes, but he didn't make a lot of progress. He read the Lotus Sutra, and he found it rather disappointing. Which, now remember, his mother was a Nichiren Buddhist, and the Lotus Sutra is supposed to be the epitome of Buddhism, and it just didn't do anything for him. He considered giving up Buddhism entirely, and then one day, when the monks were airing out books in the courtyard, Hakuin prayed to all of the Buddhas, he closed his eyes, and he grabbed one book at random. It turned out to be a collection of Zen stories from Ming Dynasty China, and he was particularly impressed with the story of a monk who kept a needle-sharp awl beside him while he meditated, so that if he started to doze off, he could stab himself with this and jar himself back into awakeness. And Hakuin decided, he was motivated by that. He said, I just need to try harder. Hakuin spent 4 years in intense and devoted meditation on the koan of the dog and the Buddha nature, mu, right? 4 years on that. And then he felt like he had had a breakthrough, a moment of enlightenment. His master, however, was not that impressed. Your spiritual experience has to be affirmed by a Zen master. And then when you truly have been awakened, you get a certificate from that master that shows that you've enlightened and allows you to teach others. So Hakuin left that master, went to several other Zen monasteries, finally found one Zen teacher whom he trusted. But this new fellow didn't put a lot of stock in Hakuin's sudden enlightenment experience. He had more experiences of varying degrees of awakening, sometimes in koan meditation, but also once when an old crazy woman was beating him with a broom as he was out begging. Another time, he was caught in a torrential downpour. The water was coming up to his knees, and suddenly he had this sort of this awakening experience, and he fell into the water. He's just so happy about this. And then once again, another experience he had while he heard the snow falling. Finally, he gained full enlightenment at the age of 41 while he was reading the Lotus Sutra, the same book that he had once been so disappointed in. A little strange that it's associated with scripture reading, because Zen is supposed to be apart from scripture reading. Okay, so he's got all these enlightenment experiences. Now, it's not gradual enlightenment, but Rinzai Zen Buddhists do distinguish between major and minor awakenings. Hakuin began to teach disciples, and eventually he returned to his hometown and established a Zen monastery that attracted students from all over the country. Okay, autobiography is fairly rare in this course. Sima Qian and Ge Hong both wrote chapters at the end of their books that tell us a little bit about themselves. Xuanzang talked about his life to a disciple who wrote a biography, but we don't really have things quite like, say, Augustine's Confessions or Al-Ghazali, the great Sufi Muslim philosopher, wrote an autobiography as well. Hakuin writes an autobiography. At the age of 81, 2 years before his death, it's a marvelous work in which he recounts his spiritual experiences and his quest for enlightenment. He gives personal examples of how the pressure and the frustration of koan practice can lead to great doubt, which can then suddenly give way to great awakening. Hakuin tells of how he wrestled with the dog and Buddha nature koan until he was beside himself. A great doubt overcame him, and he felt, he said, like he was frozen solid in a giant ice sheet that extended for thousands of miles. He just couldn't move anywhere, very uncomfortable. That state lasted for several days, and then when he chanced to hear the temple bell, he was suddenly transformed. It was like the sheet of ice had been smashed, or like a jade tower had suddenly collapsed. Okay. Unfortunately, his next thought was, wow, I bet no one has experienced an enlightenment like this in the last 200 or 300 years. So his first glimpse of awakening was almost immediately smothered by arrogance. But he has many more such awakening experiences. It's intriguing what a central role Hakuin assigns to doubt within religious life. Spiritual progress has to begin with doubt, and he says that 10 degrees of doubt will yield 10 degrees of enlightenment. The more, the better. Hakuin said that there are three things necessary for the study of Zen: a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, and great determination. Anyone who lacks one of these is like a three-legged kettle with one leg broken, he says. I like the idea of doubt being sort of at the heart of true religious feeling and experience. Hakuin was a fine teacher who communicated with students and laypersons through sermons and letters, but also through his paintings, many of which are very famous, and his songs. He even liked to go out in the fields and talk with peasants about Zen. And he wrote commentaries on the classics as well, but they're not like the commentaries of Shankara or Jushi. One of the famous lines from the Heart Sutra, and remember this is a one-page scripture from the Perfection of Wisdom tradition, is, "Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form." And in commenting on that, Hakuin wrote, "Rubbish, a useless collection of junk. Don't be trying to teach apes to climb trees." I suppose apes already know how to climb trees on their own. On the next line from the Heart Sutra, "Form is nothing but emptiness, and emptiness is nothing but form," Hakuin writes, "A nice hot kettle of stew, he ruins it by dropping a couple of rat turds in. It's no good pushing delicacies at a man with a full belly." In many ways, Hakuin's greatest sermons came from his life, and there are lots of stories. Let me give you two favorites. First, a soldier came to Hakuin and asked, "Is there really a paradise and a hell?" And Hakuin said, "Who are you?" And the samurai said, "You know, I'm a samurai." Hakuin said, "Your face looks like that of a beggar. I mean, what lord would ever hire you to be his samurai?" And the guy was angry, offended. He started to reach for a sword. Hakuin says, "Oh, you've got a sword. It's probably too dull to cut off my head." And the samurai draws his sword, and Hakuin says, "Here opens the gates of hell." And the soldier sees the Zen master's discipline, that he's unfazed, that he's calm, and he puts back the sword and he bows. Hakuin said, "Here open the gates of paradise." And the man became his disciple. Story number two. Hakuin had a reputation for a pure life. There was a young woman in the village below the monastery who found herself pregnant one day. It happens. Her parents were furious. They demanded to know who the father was. And after weeks of badgering, she finally said, "Look, the father's Hakuin." And the parents were were shocked, and they went up to the monastery. They confronted him, and Hakuin said, "Is that so?" He lost his reputation. When the child was born, the parents took it up to Hakuin and said, "You take care of this kid." And he got a wet nurse and took care of the infant. After about a year, the girl confessed to her parents that it wasn't Hakuin, it was really the boy next door. The parents went up to the monastery, they apologized profusely, they asked for the child back. Hakuin gave them the child and said, "Is that so?" Sometimes Japanese today distinguish Soto and Rinzai schools as farmer Zen and warrior Zen. I mean, Dogen's sitting meditation seems calm, almost passive compared with Hakuin's urgent, more take-charge, koan-based meditation. And indeed, Rinzai Zen has long been associated with samurai culture. It's something of a puzzle. What attraction would a religion of kindness and non-desire have to offer tough warriors? Scholars have suggested that the samurai admired the singleness of purpose, the firmness of will, the indifference to life and death that Zen taught. And they were already committed to ideals of self-sacrifice and discipline, and they were keenly aware of the impermanence of life. Actually, most samurai were probably Pure Land Buddhists. The more educated and elite samurai took a liking to Zen, but perhaps during the late medieval period in Japan, Zen was more important in the arts than as a religion. And that's an idea that we'll pick up in the next lecture. See you then.